Corporate greed is hurting Americans, not Democratic socialists, who are fighting for universal health care, child care, and clean water. The sponsor of this resolution took $10,000 from Phillips 66, a gas company, and that's a fact. And I wonder how many residents in Colorado's 5th pulled into a Phillips 66 and couldn't afford gas, because today, residents in Colorado's 5th are paying $4.26 per gallon for gas. That's higher than the national average. Colorado's 5th District are paying the cost of Trump's reckless war. Since the start of the war, the average family in the 5th District has paid an extra $412 for gas. They've spent $3,700 more for basic living expenses. But yet, we're not talking about the fact that warmongering hurts our families, not Democratic socialists. But yet here we are, blaming, again, Democratic socialists who are trying to make life easier for our families, not the billionaire class. And I proudly, as a DSA member, say, tax the rich. Thank you.
Welcome to Outside Issues with Audrey and Patrick.
My spiritual practices lately have been going to church. I go to a church over in the boonies in Washington a little bit sometimes. And it was really interesting because today's speaker was a rabbi and he was a very staunch Zionist.
Oh.
And so
we're getting right into it.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, I had a conversation with him about this afterwards, saying, you know that there's a genocide, right? And he goes, I wouldn't call it a genocide. And I said, why not? And I then blacked out a little bit in anger. Can't lie. And he said something about the October 7th attacks that I did not agree with. But the reason I came up to him was because he made a joke during the, I don't know what you want to call it, sermon. I call it speech.
The service. Yeah.
The service. He made a joke that landed very horribly.
Horribly for yourself or for the room?
For the room. For folks in the room who are Black. He mentioned, oh, I'm going to start preaching like I'm a Black person. And so he started, from what his perception was very animated and very Jesus. I love Jesus. I love Jesus. Very just, you know, very.
Was he doing like a Black voice and just kind of really hamming it up? Oh, yeah, that's no good.
Yeah. So I went up to him and I was like, look, like as somebody who has a degree in social welfare, that I'm trying to call in on top of like what we're talking about politically, I'm calling you out on that racial microaggression, because I noticed that Black folks in the service were not laughing at that joke. And because when you are mentioning things, when you're joking about things about a specific subgroup that is marginalized, that's a microaggression. And where there's people in a place that are trying to find their higher power, and you make a microaggression and a joke about, oh, this is how Black people are supposed to be preaching, or this is how Black people are supposed to be reacting to their higher power, I don't think that that's appropriate. And he was like, oh, I agree to disagree. And I was like, okay, whatever, that's fine. But I just thought it was really interesting that it was a rabbi preaching today and a Zionist.
Was there some good stuff in there? Did you find it moving?
He was talking about how Jonah got swallowed by the fish. He was just basically reading from the Old Testament, climbing out of the whale, climbing out of the fish, and having your higher power help you do that.
Coming out of the darkness.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost could be like a recovery metaphor a little bit.
Coming out of the darkness, using your higher power, using your spiritual beliefs and your spiritual practices and your spiritual mental health. But the way that he delivered it wasn't great. And I had to let him know that. And in the process, I found out that he did not agree with the word genocide. And I was like, "Woo!" Well, I really did not have a great Sunday morning.
Okay, well, it's not a genocide. So what is it? Does he take issue with the thousands and thousands of people, mostly children, who've been murdered? Is it murder? If it's not genocide, is it murder? And those are the questions I think are important to ask, because there's something of, like, genocide, the context that word is usually thrown around is like a legal context. If it's a genocide, then the International Criminal Court will adjudicate it in a specific way, and the world government is supposed to address it and do some kind of an intervention, or there should be, like, you know, ramifications for whatever party it is that's doing the genocide. How'd you know he was a Zionist? Did you key into that before you approached him?
Mm-hmm. He believes that, you know, Israel should stand alone as an ethno-state and not integrate, essentially.
He said that to the congregation?
He said that to me personally. I basically want Netanyahu to perish in hell. And I think that it's all of our duty to recognize that what we're doing is murder by funding this war, by aligning with Benjamin Netanyahu.
Just the idea of Israel. And yeah, our responsibility and our, like, commitment to Zionism, to the ethno-state of Israel, to Palestinians being dispossessed and not having equal legal rights in that place, and then us kind of writing a blank check for weapons for Israel to kind of enforce its apartheid, those things, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's difficult to talk about that with me. Because I've seen so much good and so much harm happen in this debate. And I think DSA members really need to have conversations together about trauma-informed language, I think. And when we talk about Zionism, it's a thing. And I've seen people be harmed by it. I've seen folks who are from Israel, who are in the movement, who are in the DSA movement, be discouraged because they're being called Zionists because they're from Israel. And I've seen a DSA member voice concern about something that having to do with Israel, a building in Israel or something, and being called a Zionist. You know, if somebody's from Israel and they express, "Oh, I'm upset about a building going down in Israel," and then labeling them as a Zionist, I've seen it happen. And it makes me sad because we're all in it for one purpose, and that's to make the world a better place and to end the genocide and to end the violence. And I think that division is necessary to a certain extent when it comes to especially calling out the establishment Democrats. I think that we need to really be focusing on calling them out, focusing on calling out their harm, because mm-hmm. what they're doing is harming the Palestinians. It's harming us.
I think it's really cool that you approached him and had, like, a one-to-one conversation. And I can point to, like, a couple actually specific examples in my life over the last couple months where I have not had that direct confrontation with somebody that I could tell was, like, more pro-Israel than me, expressing some bigotry. I did not engage. I did not go towards it. I go along to get along, I think, in certain situations. Some of it's my fear of confrontation. I'm kind of doing that math in my head of, like, you know, okay, who is this person? What do they matter to me? You know, what am I trying to build long-term, picking my shots, basically. When it comes to Jewish friends and Jewish neighbors, I am choosing lately to believe in the goodness of their hearts in the long arc of history. They'll be able to disavow the actions of the sovereign state of Israel, just the same way that we are. And I can understand the difficulty. The structures that they were raised in, they're there to reinforce Zionism. I just think we have to, like, trust in ourselves, Audrey, you know, that we're not operating from a place of bigotry, but of wanting to do the most life-affirming thing. Israel's got so many components to it right now, because there's the genocide, which is the most important thing. And then there's the way that American politics, and especially, like, you know, Democratic Party politics, are being subordinated to the imperial drive of Israel. Israel's imperial drive is just an extension of American imperial drive. The Israel question is, like, kind of one of the most important things in our politics right now. I am confident that we are on the right side of history about that. Because we are pro-Palestine, that doesn't mean we are anti-Jew. It's Norm Finkelstein is like this prominent scholar on Israel and Palestine. And, you know, he was making the rounds recently. He was on Hassan's Dream for a while. And then he was on Breaking Points with Crystal and Sagar. I mean, he wrote a whole book really about like what, you know, October 7th and the fallout from it. He's, you know, Jewish man and highly educated. And he says that he doesn't call it Zionism. He calls it Jewish supremacy. Just like you and I would call Nazis white supremacist. We are white, but we are not white supremacists. We do not believe that, you know, our ethnic credentials make us more, our lives more precious. You know, we don't have access to more rights. We're in a diaspora, you know, of different people. And Norm Finkelstein advises against using Zionism so broadly because, well, first and foremost, a lot of people don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. And it can kind of like be, and it's a term that, you know, like you're pointing to things like, you know, calling this person a Zionist and that person a Zionist. I don't know what this example you mentioned about like a buildings being taken down in Israel. So, you know, that person is called a Zionist is like a pejorative. What's like the woke way to talk about Zionism?
Definitely calling it an ethno state.
When you were called like a racist or you were called a bigot back in the day mm-hmm. by somebody because you said something, right? Like, what exactly happened?
What I did was obviously go to the side of my friend and console them emotionally. Politically, I cowered. I completely cowered because I was in an environment of toxic individuals. Ironically, fighting for social justice and learning about social justice. You were just talking about white nationalism as yes, we're both white. However, in this dynamic, we were always encouraged to apologize for every single thing that we were doing. We were at one point being called colonizers because, yes, technically, white people colonized America. Not everybody's ancestral background colonized America, however. And so you have to use your privilege and understand it from the lens of a BIPOC person or any person of a marginalized group. But it's also there can be this toxicity within this social justice sphere to helping the greater good.
Just because our ancestors did something horrible, and I think most of us can claim that. Mm-hmm. But I'm anti-colonizer. I'm anti-empire. I view my role. What I do with my privilege is I use it to help the dispossessed, to share what I've been given through no accomplishment of my own, but just by because I was born in a certain place, I look a certain way. But I did nothing to earn that. And so if that gets me a little further ahead in the race, I think that the right thing to do with that is to spread that around and to try to use it to kind of like lift other people up, because I think we should all be on the same level. We should all be afforded the same dignity and, you know, respect as human beings. I know that you live in that also.
1,000%. And that's what our program was supposed to be.
Right.
There's, I think, now seeing the DSA being so successful, it puts my heart to ease a little bit.
Their radicalism has not been a hindrance to them taking power or making gains. Jewish people, you know, they've got the right to tell me to fuck off. You know, there's things about their lived experience that I'll never understand. I acknowledge completely, you know, that I'm just operating from a place of limited knowledge, limited lived experience. But I'm just using what I can to the best of my abilities to kind of like live in accordance with my values. And I see a lot of Jewish organizations, pro-Palestine Jewish organizations out there in the protests in India City. And, you know, they're not monolithic. You know, I mean, I think that like a big part of the way that Israel's actions are harming Jewish people worldwide as well is that they are suggesting that all their actions are on behalf of all Jews everywhere. When in fact, it's the actions of a sovereign state and by extension, America. It's important to kind of dissuade people from any creeping anti-Semitic feelings, you know, like to tell people that like, look, you know, this is a lot of Jewish people in America and elsewhere are not with the program on this, no matter what we're being told. And to not just paint everybody of any ethnicity with the same brush.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I fully agree with you. And that's why I come from such a tricky place with with naming things.
But here's the thing, Audrey, like, what do you have to be guilty about, really, as far as all that goes? You use your words very carefully. I think you lead more with tolerance and sensitivity and empathy, much more than I do, you know, in many contexts. And not only that, but it's bolstered by a lot of education. And so that needs to be the next chapter of your life, is kind of like just finally doing the inventory, right? And just kind of putting all that stuff to bed, because, you know, you got nothing to be feel guilty about, or, you know, it's sounds like whatever somebody said to you in your past about, you know, you being a colonizer, you being intolerant, it sounds like there's stuff that they're projecting on you. It doesn't sound like anything you did.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that there some folks in my cohort are pieces of shit, and I'm really concerned about the folks that they serve, if they're licensed social workers now. But you know what? That's on them, and I hope they do no harm. Speaking of doing no harm, though, the right and a good part of the establishment are trying to harm our Hassan Piker here. They're trying and I'm loving how scared they're getting of him.
I wanted to pick up where you left off. I just wanted to be clear about which candidates Hassan has campaigned with, or kind of like done media to boost. He's been supporting Abdullah Sayed in Michigan, who is not a DSA-backed candidate or endorsed candidate necessarily, but he's been lumped in with them because he's kind of anti-establishment and he's pro-Palestine. So it's Abdullah Sayed from Michigan, Adam Hamawi from New Jersey, Chris Rabb in Pennsylvania, Cory Bush, of course, a member of the squad from Missouri. We've got Francesca Hong, the Wisconsin governor, who lost her election recently. Claire Valdez and Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier from New York. That's enough. I mean, there's more, but like what Hassan has been doing ever since Trump's win and since Mamdani's win. I mean, he was also campaigning pretty hard to get Zohran Mamdani elected in New York. Is that he's really been kind of like using his celebrity capital and, you know, his popularity on Twitch to build interest and energy behind these different challenges to the Democratic establishment, to kind of try and get some kind of like a winning coalition together to fight fascism, the fascism of Trump that was ascendant, certainly. I mean, it's still ascendant, but definitely that first year in 2024. Some kind of challenge to it electorally. And as a result, you know, the James Carvilles of the world, the, you know, Chuck Schumers, the Hakeem Jeffries, the kind of like the Nancy Pelosi's, you know, the kind of like machine Democrat political operatives really don't like that. You know, one, because of ideology, their careers were built on donations from billionaires and, you know, from pro-Israel groups and stuff like that. And so they know where their bread is buttered. And, you know, that's that they're kind of there to like not be permissive of people like Hassan. And then also their like organizational power, you know, like if all of these progressive socialist challengers get in there into these seats, that kind of, and the American people, the voting population has shown that this is a recipe for, you know, for beating Republicans at the ballot, then all of a sudden those consultants, that a certain type of politician will become irrelevant. And I mean, and as far as I'm concerned, in 2024, they were proved irrelevant, you know, by the fact that Trump was elected a second time. And, you know, Republicans just made all these gains, you know, down ballot in that election. But for all these reasons, and I'll stop gabbing, Hassan has become has a big target on his back. And like what they've chosen to do, they don't, the Democratic establishment doesn't really want to talk about Hassan's, you know, whatever policies he's advocating for, and they don't want to talk about ideological matters necessarily. They just want to focus on his character. They want to, like, you know, build him into this person that's like this an onerous individual, And, you know, and that's the problem. And that's what we all need to be focusing on. Because I think if they were to really, it's been pointed out that like very few of these media sources like CNN, you know, or like the different kind of op-eds that have been written in mainstream media, like anti-Assange op-eds, none of them have interviewed him directly.
Has he really been interviewed directly? Like,
no, I mean, Semaphore, there's some kind of prominent, I think a journal or like media called Semaphore. This guy, Dave Weigel, who does a lot of really great election coverage, interviewed Assange recently about this controversy. But they're, I think, yeah, the dynamic is that they're talking about him constantly, but they're not talking to him. And, you know, Assange is pretty open and willing to talk to people. You know, it's not a question of like, well, he just wasn't available. It's that I think they don't want to get him talking, because if they get him talking, maybe people will like what he has to say. And that would, you know, disengage their argument somehow.
And that's a big reason why I don't know if I told you this, but he was poised to make a speech at University of Washington last month. And then the last second they pulled it, citing a reason of ideology, which who the fuck knows what that means. But I was like, I wonder what that is. But second of all, why is everybody so scared? But third of all, I love how everybody's scared. Like, and that's why I get that dopamine hit of whenever a DSA candidate wins, I get that dopamine of hope. Just that.
Dope of hope.
The dope of hope. You know, I used to do dope. Now I do hope, but I'm not the corny NA person of a hope dealer, not dope dealer. I'm not doing that and not doing that trope of NA.
But I do like there was a guy. I love this guy. I'm trying to remember his name, and he's like a biker, and he used to call himself a dopeless hope fiend, which I always liked.
I've met that guy, I think.
Yeah, you have. He's nice, I think. Yeah, you know, yeah. You met him probably. Yeah. Do you remember his name?
I don't remember his name, but I know the saying.
Yeah, yeah. He used to always hang out in the smoking pit outside the meeting.
So Patrick lovingly gifted me a membership to Town Hall Seattle, which has a lot of political discussions, a lot of artistic discussions, which they actually can be, you know, sought online. So even you can probably be privy to it. A lot of creative works. Last night's conversation was with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, and she was hosting two people, two authors, one of which is a congressman. I completely forget his name. I believe his first name was Ben. He was talking, they were mainly talking about January 6th and white nationalism, white Christian nationalism in particular, and how the white Christian nationalism movement fueled January 6th. And Sky Perrimus, her name, one of the authors was, I bought her book, and I don't read, so this is a big deal that I bought her book. Her name was Sky Perriman, I believe. That could also be a music artist, so I'm going to have to double check with the name, but her first name was Sky. What she did was she wrote a book that I stupidly did not write down the title, but essentially it's like a guideline for how to help the working class person while we're in these unprecedented times of information. So she discussed a lot about you know, taking in news sources and figuring out what's, you know, ethical versus unethical in yourself and in other people, specifically within yourself, which I thought was really interesting. There's something that she talked about called media sobriety, where it's like you don't, you know, you take in a certain amount of information, you put it aside, and then you decide to do what you want to do with it. Obviously, I haven't read the whole book, but I've skimmed through it, and it's like a guideline book, and it's very, very satisfying to look at. But essentially, yeah, the talk was with Congresswoman Jayapal and these two authors talking about Christian nationalism and just January 6th and how incredibly devastating that event was. and how, what we can do to prevent it.
You've got a packed schedule, a clinical schedule, you know, and you've got a lot of personal stuff going on. So where does, how do you stay informed in a way that doesn't like totally fuck you up?
Listen to KULW, KU, KWOU. KUOW.
Elemental P?
KUOW, Seattle's NPR station.
All right.
Yeah.
Classic.
It's very mellow. That's how I get most of my news just every morning, KUOW. And you know what's funny is actually I was listening to Majority Report the other morning while I was taking a shower, and I heard Sam mention a source he uses. It might have been an ad, but for Ground News, the Ground News app. I don't know if you've checked it out, but it's
Ground News. No,
it's a completely neutral news website where it says this is from a Democratic or left leaning source, and this is from a right leaning source, and then this is from a neutral source like Reuters or for AP, something like that. And so I've checked out the app, and it's quite interesting. You just have to sort of shift through what's misinformation, what's not. But I think Sam has a good idea there of just looking at things neutrally from like a mindfulness perspective, like we were talking about with Ren and non-judgment. Looking at headlines and saying, oh, where did this come from? Where did this come from? And that's kind of how I look at it, just neutral. I try to look at it really neutrally. But then, of course, I'm human and I'm a radical leftist. So I get very upset and I get very emboldened to say stuff and to think stuff. But maybe I'm not there yet with the overwhelmed over news kind of situation.
Yeah,
what I get overwhelmed with is carrying emotional weight lately. And that's why I'm turning so much to the aspect of hope with all of these wins for DSA. Putting out a lot of emotional labor that's with people who view the world negatively because of their mental illness. And of course they do. You know, if you're suffering, you're suffering. I think that seeing these folks stand up for what's right in our country and actually wanting to take necessary, maybe unpopular steps towards goodness, it makes me feel a little lighter. It makes me cling on to that hope of, okay, things will improve, even if, you know, the shit is like just all over the place in the world right now. Shit is all over the place in all of my clients' lives right now. I can't really do much about either one of those except comment and guide. But I do find these candidates winning as some sort of light at the end of the tunnel, where each day I'm seeing the tunnel close or seemingly close every single day with individual people. And I'm getting more and more frustrated with the system and emotionally how people's emotional health are coinciding with the system even more, because I'm seeing people who are on Medicaid and have housing instability, and there's suicidality associated with that, so much suicidality associated with unhousing and with food scarcity, and even transportation. Like, there are folks that over here that can't get to a doctor's appointment unless it's by transit, and that's 3 hours of transit time. So it's like, when I see these candidates winning and beating what was, it makes me feel hopeful for a new breakthrough. And I'm hoping that I can see some sort of breakthrough in the world like this, even if I'm not seeing breakthroughs with people I'm seeing individually. We're done with being pussies, essentially.
Yeah. Well, people need relief. People need relief. I showed you that Brace Belden Doom Scroll. I love that show, by the way. I love the format. Brace was talking about how, you know, he's actually further to the left than Zoran Mamdani, but he was out there campaigning for him and, you know, just door knocking and stuff. And he went to the festivities afterwards. Like, he likes Zoran quite a bit. He's glad he's mayor, but he just needed his rent to go down. You know, like that's the main, and the way he talked about voting was that, like, look, it's, and this is the way I feel about voting, is that, what else was I doing that day? You know, like it's a nominal effort that you make, to kind of like, improve, you know, your material quality of life, hopefully, or maybe prevent, you know, something bad happening to a neighbor. The Republican Party is not interested in addressing the material issues of people. And you know, as it happens, the Democrat political establishment isn't interested in addressing those things. So that creates an opportunity, which these candidates that you're pointing to have been seizing upon. And that just seems like the only direction to go. You know, it's the, you know, and people like, I am not, even if Trump was able to pick up support and from independents and from first time voters, and in 2024, you know, there were like all these gains, you know, that the right made. You know, I still believe that, you know, like a plurality of Americans, you know, a plurality of people, you know, are in line with the kind of politics that you and I are interested in, you know, and the kind of better world that you and I are interested in. It's just that in a void, you know, in a world where these types of candidates like Angie Nixon or like Abdullah Al-Sayed or like Zoran Mamdani, in a world where, you know, those two never get in front, that those guys never get in front of a microphone, you know, then things do default to the right, you know, to the forces of fascism. It's the structures kind of dictating a certain status quo that, you know, if that gives me despair, you know, that's the thing that gives me despair, not, you know, what's in the hearts of people or my neighbors. Or I think, you know, more often than not, you know, they want what's best for their children. If we're feeling despair, you know, I think there's enough evidence to, you know, to make that reasonable. But if we're feeling despair, let our despair lead us into some form of action that will be able to give some relief to us or others. Let those feelings motivate you into doing something loving and positive and compassionate, and courageous. Do the next life-affirming thing.
I also think I've always dreamed of the day. I think it's a generational thing, and it's a running joke with, you know, Senator Mitch McConnell being a essential rubber chicken, you know, on a breeding.
The very much alive.
Gentleman
from Kentucky.
Yes, very much alive. I think that while that generation is quite literally dying, I think our generation and the generation even below us, you know, because some of these candidates are a couple years younger than us, actually. Which makes me feel AOC's, real.
Yeah, I think AOC is younger than me.
She is younger than me, too. And so I think it's a big generational thing because the boomers don't get it.
I never like to condescend to people younger than me. You know, it's like.
You do.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm like.
Well, I guess it would depend on what's the thing. What are we condescending about?
Oh, usually a 2000s culture.
Because
the Gen Z is trying to bring back early 2000s culture. And if you're a woman, you would understand. No, not saying that you don't understand the horribleness, which was the 2000s. But as a young woman growing up in the early 2000s, it was very body shaming, very misogynistic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was hard being a woman or a female presenting person or a AFAB person, assigned female at birth person during the 2000s because of the societal and the cultural and pop culture takeover. So I think that millennials in particular, we're a different breed. And I've been just, you know, happy that Mitch McConnell is on his way out. And metaphorically, that they're all on their way out. And we can they can be replaced by younger folks like us who have, quite frankly, better interests in heart because we've lived through these experiences as young people. Whereas people in generations before us, they survived horrors too. However, there's some disconnect.
They were born in like the during the time of spoils from World War II and of like great economic expansion. And you know, it's funny, Sam on the Majority Report, they were like looking at some clip, like the idea of any boomer being against the principle of forgiving student debt. When the tuition, when they were growing up, college tuition was just a fraction of, you know, it was such a minimal cost to go to a good college in their day. You know, they didn't need to accrue debt, you know, and the wages were more in line with the income that they were getting. So it's, they were able to do that. You know, the context is just completely different now. And, you know, I think that's when we talk about being, you know, shut up, boomer. it's shut up. It's shut up the idea of kind of like standing in the way of, you know, millennials and Zoomers enjoying a comparable quality of life to the one that they had in their time. There just seems to be a total disconnect between, you know, what the people are asking for and what the politicians are willing or able to give them.
And it looks like these DSA candidates and these more left wing candidates are promising these things that we're asking for. And I think that if you want to look at it as like a higher power and spiritual perspective, I think we need to step into an age of abundance. And it looks like from my eyes, it looks like all of these winds are beginning in an age of abundance, an abundance of hope, an abundance of understanding of what needs to be called out, what needs to be changed, what needs to be established, and what maybe needs to be abolished.
The structures of American politics are still governed by money, and money doesn't want things to change, you know, because they want the rich want to maintain their place at the top of the pecking order, and they can only maintain their place under capitalism at the top of the pecking order by keeping everybody else down. To vote and to run these good left wing candidates in primaries, but to kind of keep, and I think Hassan does a great job of this, keep an adversarial position towards that entrenched capital uniformly on the right and you know, the leadership of Democratic Party. And it's going to be, you know, they're not going to give up without a fight. Number one and number two Democrat in America take billionaire money and take, you know, money from AIPAC and don't want to see things change and are, you know, directly involved with this whole kind of Hassan smearing Abdul Sayed smearing operations.
It's not because like there's any Islamophobia or anything going on at all. Not at all.
That's part of it. Yeah, that's part of it. He's a really, by the way, can I just say, Abdul Sayed is a really kind of Clooney-esque guy. Like he's really, I think he's very kind of like, you know, masculine and cool. Yeah, he's kind of a sexy guy. And, you know,
all these
like
guys, all these DSA guys are so hot.
Yeah. You know what's funny is so I'm not the biggest fan, but I thought it was pretty funny. I saw a clip of Obama on one of the podcasts yesterday, and he said that women used to grab his butt when he would go and
that's
do
not okay.
I know it's not okay, but it's just, but he was kind of like, you know, I think he was saying that he, some of that attention he low-key kind of liked, you know, because
oh,
at the time
I feel like there's a bravery in the air and some hopefulness in the air. Some of us are who on the left who are particularly wanting to see things change very rapidly and radically. I think that this feeling of hope is being, you know, like maybe we shouldn't like lean into it because look at what happened with Obama, you know, like the hope, change, everything. Everybody went all in and then the administration was obviously not Perfect.
The key is to be attentive through that process and to be willing to call our people into account, you know, if we feel that things are kind of sliding off the rails. And that's something that I think liberal, progressive, left people could have done a better job about.
What I try to focus on in the positive of the Obama era and the positive of my drinking, to be honest, was when Obama got elected, I did run through Westwood Boulevard with a glass of champagne barefoot.
That's, I would have loved to see that. I wish we could have hung out during that time. I could have used a friend.
I had some interesting friends during college in 2008. But like, I think the hope is there. I think we need to tread lightly and carry a big stick.
Yeah. You're so funny, by the way, just running barefoot down. You said Westwood with the glass of champagne.
Westwood Boulevard, Westwood and Gailey or something like that. Just mm-hmm. right in the heart of the village, just right in front of the hospital.
Well, you don't do anything half-assed.
Oh, yes, I do.